Chapter 11 With the Swamis in Ceylon. Though the headquarters of the unit were in Delhi, there were branches in Calcutta, Madras, and even further afield. Shortly after my visit to the Birla Mandir, I learned that two or three operators were to be posted to the Ceylon branch. Perhaps the sight of the Buddha image and of the yellow robes drying in the sun had made me nostalgic for Buddhism, for I at once volunteered to go. 3 days later, with a technical sergeant and another operator, I was on my way. Kolupitiya, where the Ceylon branch was located, was a suburb of Colombo. Branching off from the main coastal road, which ran from the city down to Mount Lavinia and the southern tip of the island, a lane wandered between coconut palms into a small compound. On the right stood the western-type house in which we worked and ate. On the left, the palm-leaf bungalow where we lived. Over the compound wall was the railway line, along which overcrowded trains dashed with white-clad passengers clinging onto doors and windows and even sitting on the roof. On the other side of the track ran a narrow strip of rocky beach, while below the beach lay the sea, off which there blew, night and day, a strong wind. Colombo was smaller and more westernised than New Delhi. Before many days had passed, I knew my way about the main streets, was a regular visitor to the roomy premises of the forces canteen, and had penetrated into the Sinhalese quarter. I never tired of looking into the jeweller's windows, which were alive with the rainbow colours of the precious and semi-precious stones in which Ceylon abounds. Half the shops in town but seemed to belong to jewellers. There was at least one good bookshop, though. Here I found, and promptly purchased, Romain Rolland's biographies of the Bengali saint Sri Ramakrishna and his famous disciple Swami Vivekananda. Years later, when my enthusiasm for the Ramakrishna Vivekananda literature had waned, I was to wonder why they had attracted me so powerfully. Perhaps it was because they demonstrated that the spiritual life, far from being practicable only in the remote past, could be, and in fact had been, lived in modern times. Perhaps because they indirectly encouraged me not merely to study, but actually to practice the teaching to which I was already committed, the teaching of the Buddha. Be that as it may, I had hardly started reading the two biographies when, looking one day for Buddhist temples on the fly-blown map of Colombo that hung on the wall of the unit, I saw against a black dot the words Vivekananda Society. Excited by the discovery, I could not rest until, with much difficulty, I had located the place. It consisted of a small building with a library and reading room. Nobody there seemed able to tell me anything about Ramakrishna and Vivekananda, but a stout elderly man with a very black complexion gave me the address of a monastery at Welawatta, where there was a branch of the Ramakrishna mission, and the name of the Swami or Hindu monk in charge. Welawatta, the suburb in which the ashram or monastery was situated, lay only 2 miles south of Kolupitiya. For much of the way the road was lined with giant flame-of-the-forest trees, the orange-red blossoms of which littered the pavements. As I walked past the big suburban villas, Chinese restaurants, and Sinhalese toddy shops, over a bridge, and then past rows of palm-leaf boutiques and dilapidated cement dolls' houses, I felt intensely excited. What would the Swami be like? Did he know English? Would he agree to see me? To teach me? One of the books on Indian philosophy I had been reading stated that a holy man should never be approached without an offering. But the boutiques contained only green bananas, or plantains as they are called in the East, which in my ignorance I thought were unripe, and I was therefore forced to turn into the by-lane in which the monastery was situated, empty-handed. I need not have worried. After I had waited a few minutes on the inner veranda, a door opened, and there emerged a tall, rather portly man in salmon-pink robes. In excellent English, though with a strong accent, he asked what he could do for me. Gaining confidence from the friendly expression on his plump face, I told him about the events which had led me to the Vivekananda Society and thence to the monastery. All the books I had read recently, I explained, had emphasized that without a teacher, no spiritual progress was possible. Could he help me? What the Swami said in reply, I do not remember, but he invited me to visit the monastery whenever I liked. Before I left, a servant brought a plate of fruit, cut into tiny cubes, and some Indian sweetmeats. Nothing was said about my having omitted to bring an offering. Thereafter, I spent nearly all my evenings at the ashram, as I discovered the monastery was called. This was possible partly because of its nearness to the unit, and partly because of the nature of the shift system under which the 24 or so operators who made up the unit's Colombo branch worked. At first we had 4 hours on and 8 hours off duty alternately, right round the clock, with no day off. Thus I had the afternoon and evening free 3 days out of four. Later the system was changed. For a 24-hour period we had 4 hours on and 4 hours off duty alternately, after which we were free for 24 hours. Except that I sometimes operated the link with Delhi, my duties were the same as before. Earphones clamped to my head, left hand resting on the high-powered receiving set, I scoured the air for the faintest signals, listening carefully and logging anything that sounded suspicious. Sometimes I wrote poetry, penning stanzas when I should have intercepted. Jock, the tall Scots technical sergeant who was in charge of the office, had no interest in life other than work, and looked after the operators like a father. The OC, a captain, we saw only on paydays, when he sat at his table bareheaded, so that we would not have to salute him. The military atmosphere was, in fact, completely lacking. There were neither parades nor inspections. So little did regular army imbecilities interfere with my studies and literary work at this period, that apart from the V-Day celebrations, which were quiet enough, I have only the vaguest memories of unit life. In the copper-coloured light which suffused the atmosphere every evening, turning the vegetation in the compound a deep rich green, all worldly preoccupations seemed to dissolve. The ashram at Welawatta, which nestled among coconut palms only a stone's throw from the beach, consisted of three units, hall, shrine room and residence, enclosing a little square of garden. The veranda of the residential quarter, which made up two sides of the square, faced inwards onto beds of fragrant flowering shrubs. Here I sat in the cool of the evening and discussed Indian philosophy, religion and culture with the two resident Swamis. Swami Siddhatmananda, the ashram president, who had received me on my first visit, was a Bengali. Joining the Ramakrishna mission as a youth, he passed through the regular stages of probation and novitiate, and in accordance with the mission custom, was posted, after ordination, to centres in India and abroad. Besides running the ashram, he supervised the schools which the mission conducted in different parts of Ceylon. Swami Vipulananda was a Tamil, that is to say, a native of the Tamil-speaking region of South India. of medium height and so dark as to make the whites of his eyes very noticeable, he spoke English with a delightful South Indian burr. A renowned scholar who specialised in the history of Tamil music, he had become a Swami very late in life. Despite his obvious frailty, he was still active as head of the Department of Tamil in the Ceylon University. My contact with these two Swamis, who in many cases complemented each other, was of inestimable value to me, and my debt to them is very great. From them I imbibed not only something of the spirit of Indian culture, but also, what was more important, an enthusiasm for the spiritual life. Before many weeks had passed, I was as much an inmate of the ashram as it was possible to be without sleeping there. Knowledge and understanding of Indian culture was at least partly dependent on a familiarity with the Indian way of life. Swami Siddhatmananda not only expounded the Vedanta, but invited me to dinner. Helped on by kindly words of encouragement from him and Swami Vipulananda, I learned to sit cross-legged on a little wooden plank and to eat rice and curries with my fingers from a large circular brass tray placed directly on the stone floor. The cook, who watched my efforts with amusement, remarked that I ate like a crow. By this he meant that my fingers, instead of being loose and flexible, stabbed at the food with the sharp, jerky movements of a crow pecking with its beak. Later, after several years of practice, I was to hear that remark in many parts of India. In fact, I used to tell the Swamis that I found it more difficult to eat with my fingers than to understand the metaphysics of Shankara, the great exponent of non-dualist Vedanta. One of them was a meat-eater and one a vegetarian, and since they came one from the northeast, where sweets are favoured, and one from the south, which prefers sour food, I tasted dishes of many kinds. Moreover, I sampled not only the Indian, but also the Sinhalese type of cooking. Just as in Europe, every country, so in India, every province has its own distinctive food habits. Bengalis have a weakness for sweetmeats. Tamils take chilies by the handful. Gujaratis put sugar into their curries and spices into their tea. Punjabis are fond of curd preparations. Malabaris love tamarind. While in the northwest the staple diet is wheat, the rest of the country lives on rice. An appreciation of the culinary variety to be found in India provides, perhaps, a good basis for the understanding of its cultural and religious diversity. Another good basis for understanding is music. In Delhi, I had sometimes listened to Indian music, both popular and classical, for it was my conviction that what a man belonging to one culture has produced could, by virtue of their common humanity, be appreciated by a man belonging to another. At first, the sounds meant absolutely nothing to me, but gradually I was able to distinguish something like a melody. At the ashram, musical items occupied more than half the programme at all meetings and celebrations, to which flocked chiefly the music-loving Tamils. After the speeches, nearly always of extraordinary length, the platform would be cleared for the musicians. All sat cross-legged on the carpet, with their unfamiliar instruments tucked into their thigh, or laid across their knees, or upright before them. On and on they played, hour after hour, while the audience, which apparently never tired, followed their movements with gleaming eyes and smiles of approval, giving vent now and then to exclamations of delight at some particularly brilliant display of virtuosity. To me, the most interesting were the violinists, thin, elderly men who played with closed eyes and beatific expressions, holding their instruments high in the air and twisting and swaying their bodies in time with the music. On one occasion, a woman played on the musical glasses, an ancient Tamil instrument, striking them smartly with her palms, and producing clear, bell-like notes of an astonishing purity. As I had done at Delhi, I at first always strove to distinguish the melody. But Swami Vipulananda, who is both musicologist and connoisseur, advised me to listen instead to the tablas, these small round side drums, and to try and follow the rhythm. Though I was never able to appreciate all the subtleties of Indian rhythm, the most highly developed in the world, I soon found that this method enabled me to appreciate Indian music to a much greater extent than before. Such gatherings were also the means of introducing me to the devotees and friends of the ashram, with one or two of whom I had already become acquainted. My greatest friend was Chilia, a thin, youngish Tamil with great doe-like eyes, whose hair had already started thinning. The Swamis used to remonstrate with him on account of his strict vegetarianism, for he was very anemic. When his first child, a boy, died soon after birth, Swami Vipulananda told him roundly, "Your so-called religion has killed your son." He listened with a bright apologetic smile and said nothing. One day he took me inside a small wayside temple dedicated to Ganesha, the elephant-headed god. I was rather shocked by the dust and cobwebs, the old beer bottles on the altar, and the casual manner in which the priest, a filthy Brahmin, performed the ritual. When I told the Swamis about it, they admitted that the condition of most of the smaller temples in India was equally bad. Chilia, however, who seemed quite oblivious to the squalor, said his prayers with evident devotion. In this he was characteristic of his race and religion. Few Hindus will admit that the untidiness of a temple, or the slovenliness, or even immorality of a priest, need be an obstacle to one who genuinely desires to worship God. In the ashram chapel, where pictures of Ramakrishna, Vivekananda, and Sarada Devi, the Holy Mother, occupied the place of honour, marble slabs shone like glass, and brass altar vessels as gold. Though many Tamils came to the ashram, which in fact was the cultural and religious centre of the more educated and well-to-do section of the Indian community, I never met there a single Sinhalese. One day I asked Swami Siddhatmananda why no bhikshus, or Buddhist monks, ever attended the lectures. "They did sometimes come," he says, "but always insisted on standing at the back of the hall, as in Ceylon it was not the custom for monks to sit with laymen. Moreover, since the enjoyment of music was prohibited for them, they had to leave as soon as the musical items began. Under these circumstances, collaboration was difficult." With one Sinhalese monk, however, they were on very friendly terms. This was Walpola Rahula, the famous political monk, then at the height of his fame. Even before meeting him at the ashram, I had heard much of his doings, for the Ceylon Buddhist Sangha, or monastic order, was rent into two factions, one enthusiastically supporting him, the other violently opposing. The Dhammapada I had bought in Delhi defined a bhikkhu as one who had control over his hands and feet. But as I watched him talking to the Swamis, who sat relaxed and composed, I could not help noticing the constant agitation of his whole body, especially of his legs, which he jerked up and down as if to relieve some acute nervous tension. Though obviously a man of uncommon intelligence, he gave not the slightest indication of spirituality. Sometimes I accompanied the Swamis when they called on their friends. With one, a prominent advocate, I discussed Tamil mystic poetry. Swami Vipulananda took me to the university, where I met several of his colleagues, some of whom used to give lectures at the ashram. Once we attended a semi-political meeting at which a small, excitable South Indian named Ponnabalam, who often came to see the Swamis, spoke for more than 2 hours in Tamil, a language which, according to a story which Swami Vipulananda related to me, sounded like the rattling of stones in a brass pot. Ponnabalam was later to make a name for himself in Ceylon politics as the leader of the Tamil community. More interesting was the convocation of Vidyalankara Piruvenna, a famous Buddhist monastic college 5 or 6 miles from Colombo, where I heard the Indian philosopher-statesman Dr. Radhakrishnan deliver the convocation address. As we drove to the gate, I noticed that the traffic, consisting of several hundred cars, was being very efficiently controlled by the nods and smiles of a single yellow-robed figure. "Why don't they have a policeman?" I asked. "Oh, one bhikkhu can do the job better than a dozen policemen," I was told. "No one would dare to disobey a bhikkhu." Inside the gate stood a small temple. To my astonishment, it contained not an image of the Buddha, as I had expected, but figures of various Hindu gods. "These are just for the lay people," explained the bhikkhu who had received us with a superior smile. "We never worship them." As we edged our way to our seats, a very fat, dark monk, sitting at the end of the row in front, turned round and regarded me with curiosity. This was Jagdish Kashyap, who 4 years later became my teacher in Pali and Buddhist philosophy. At the ashram a day or two later, I again saw Dr. Radhakrishnan, a slim, erect figure in long black coat and white turban. He had the features of a Mughal emperor. When Swami Siddhakmananda told him I was deeply interested in Indian philosophy, he gave me a sharp, astonished glance. But I did not venture to approach, for my eyes, which had been for several days badly inflamed, were now extremely sore, and the lids so gummed together I could hardly see. The most interesting person I met through the good offices of the Swamis was the Yoga Swami of Jaffna in northern Ceylon. Since Swami Vipulananda, who always spoke of him with the deepest respect, had already aroused my interest by recounting well-authenticated stories of the holy man's extraordinary powers, it was with considerable excitement that I learned of his unexpected arrival in Colombo. One evening the Swamis took me to see him. Swami Vipulananda prostrated himself before the Yoga Swami with great humility, which astonished me, for though I was accustomed to seeing people prostrate themselves in front of the Swamis, I had not yet seen either of them pay such respect to anyone else. The Yoga Swami reclined in an armchair. The perfect whiteness of his long hair and beard contrasted with the blackness of his short, powerfully built body. But his most noticeable feature was his eyes, which were of extraordinary size and brilliance. He seemed to be about 80. Swami Vipulananda, who was over 60, afterwards told me that the Swami had not changed at all in 50 years, and that old people had said the same thing when he was a boy. Though no one knew exactly how old he was, he was believed to be not less than 160. Summer and winter he wore only a short white loincloth, being completely indifferent to heat, cold and wet. After exchanging a few words with Swami Vipulananda in Tamil, the Yoga Swami turned his great lustrous eyes on me and began speaking in broken English. During our conversation, I had an uncanny sense that he was following my every thought. This feeling was intensified by the way he sometimes answered questions I had not formulated. Of our conversation, I remember only him saying that he had been born in a Christian family and named John, but had reverted to Hinduism. Every now and then he ran his hand up and down my arm, squeezing it as he did so, and muttering, half to himself, "Very good boy, very good boy," and "Very good chair, I can sit on this chair. Very good boy, very good chair." When the servant came with cut fruits, he solemnly distributed them to us, saying as he did so, "This is my body. Take, eat." The attraction I now felt for the spiritual life was stimulated not only by what Hindus called satsang, or personal contact with saints, but by reading. In the course of the 7 months I spent in Ceylon, I either bought or borrowed from the ashram nearly all the Ramakrishna Mission publications. Once, after I had read a volume of biographical sketches of Sri Ramakrishna's dozen or so disciples, representing almost as many types of spirituality, Swami Siddhatmananda asked me to name the disciple whose life I was most desirous of emulating. "Swami Saradananda," I replied without hesitation. "Why?" "Because he combined intense external activity with perfect internal tranquility." Later I realized that the archetype of this ideal was the wise and compassionate Bodhisattva, of whom an ancient Buddhist text says, "Like a fire, his mind constantly blazes up into good works for others. At the same time, he always remains merged in the calm of the trances and formless attainments." Swami Siddhatmananda, with whom I studied some of the works of Shankara verse by verse, also took the trouble of procuring rare books for me from South India. Not all my reading was Vedantic, though. Shortly after my arrival, I joined the Colombo Public Library. Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling, the reading of which constituted my introduction to the putative father of existentialism, impressed and astonished me by the way in which it paired both philosophy and religion down to the quick of experience. Poetry was rather neglected, though I continued to write it on duty. But Bridges' The Testament of Beauty gave me, as the symposium had done much earlier, glimpses of a world wherein the true and the beautiful are one. From odd corners in obscure stationers' shops, I unearthed books and pamphlets on Buddhism published in Ceylon. Unlike the Ramakrishna Mission literature, they were dry and dull, and more than one appeared to suggest that Buddhism had been spiritually dead for 2,000 years. Buddhism as personal religion, however, a lecture delivered in Ceylon by the Indian Buddhist scholar Dr. Beni Madhav Barua, exercised a permanent influence on my understanding of the Buddha's teaching. With so much study of religious literature, all of which, whether Hindu or Buddhist, emphasized the importance of meditation, I was naturally eager to continue my own experiments in this line. They had begun in Delhi, where I had practiced the technique of dissociation described by Shankara in his Aparokshanubhuti. Sitting cross-legged inside my mosquito curtain, I had reflected that I was not the body, not the mind, not the empirical ego. I was the non-dual reality itself, the absolute existence, knowledge, bliss. Now, having progressed as far as I could by this method, I decided, without saying anything to the Swamis, to take up the practice of pranayama, or breath control, as outlined in Swami Vivekananda's Raja Yoga. Once again, therefore, I sat cross-legged beneath my mosquito curtain while others slept, this time inhaling, retaining, and exhaling my breath in accordance with the prescribed technique. After a few days, various abnormal experiences started occurring. Generally, it was as though tremendous forces descended into me from an infinite height with a terribly disintegrating effect upon my whole being. Sometimes I felt I was being slowly lifted up into the air, then dashed violently to the ground. Since these experiences did not lead to peace of mind, happiness, or illumination, I soon gave up practicing pranayama. But the experiences continued. For about 3 more weeks they disturbed me, sometimes interrupting my sleep 7 or 8 times in the course of a single night. It seemed that I was getting shocks of tremendously high voltage from a great dynamo of spiritual electricity, the assaults of which I was powerless to resist. So violent were these shocks, and so extraordinary the experiences which accompanied them, that I sometimes prayed to whom I knew not, "O Lord, take them away, and let me rest." Hindu yogis whom I subsequently met told me that without a highly qualified guide, the practice of pranayama was extremely dangerous. Some declared that by writing on a subject in which he was himself so imperfectly versed, Swami Vivekananda had done a great deal of harm. A few, among them one of exceptionally high attainments, were emphatic that this form of Raja Yoga is of no spiritual value whatever. Despite the time and energy I devoted to them, Vedantic study and yogic practice could not disturb my basic loyalty, which was to Buddhism. With the unit cook, a devout old Sinhalese who dressed in a belted sarong, shirt and jacket, and wore his hair in a bun, I visited the large new temple at Bambalapitiya. In the central shrine were 3 enormous Buddha images, one standing, one recumbent, and one sedent. Though the incense-laden atmosphere of the place, with its masses of fragrant temple flowers and groups of little guttering candles on long marble-topped tables, was more congenial to me than that of the ashram chapel, the brightly painted images were too much like gigantic wax dolls to inspire me to devotion. In April 1945, I applied for a week's leave and made a pilgrimage to the Dalada Malegawa, the Tooth Relic Temple at Kandy. Leaving Colombo in the late afternoon, the train wound slowly up to the last capital of the Kings of Ceylon through picturesque mountain scenery. As night fell, tiny orange fires gleamed from the darkness of the jungle slopes. Soon after 8, the moon, almost at full, soared from behind the black shoulder of the mountain, and at once the whole landscape gleamed silver. By the time we reached Kandy, the moon stood high in the sky. I drove through the moonlit streets to the Buddhist College hostelry where I was to stay. Around my thatched bungalow, the sanded compound, was a pool of dazzling whiteness. Refreshed by a wash, I sauntered out past the whitewashed bulk of the giant reliquary that, strangely insubstantial, sparkled on the right-hand side of the path, and strolled as far as the mustard-yellow gateway. Nothing but the uncanny brightness and silence of the night. On the opposite side of the road, the pointed octagonal roof of the temple library was silhouetted against the starry sky. Next morning, without understanding quite how it happened, I found myself in the hands of a guide, a skinny elderly man who spoke the same broken English and wore the same greasy bun and hybrid costume as the eunuch cook. It was full moon day, he told me, and we hurried, we would be able to get into the temple before the crowd. On the way, we met a little wizened monk of about 90, bowling along in a rickshaw. My guide at once dropped onto one knee and joined his hands in salutation. A brief conversation ensued, of which I understood not a word. But the monk looked at me with a friendly smile and nodded. "He high priest," said my guide, when the rickshaw had passed on. "He say we go side door, 10 o'clock open." For this favour, which meant that I would be allowed inside the shrine before the main entrance was opened to the worshippers, my guide seemed to think it only right that I should make an offering. "What would the high priest like?" I asked dubiously. "He very fond plum cake. You give 1 pound English plum cake, he much happy. He like nothing on earth like English plum cake." I handed over a note, the first of the many that were to pass between us that week. The approach to the temple enclosure was lined with beggars, even more horribly diseased and deformed than those I had seen in India. Frescoes, hardly less horrible, depicted sinners being impaled, roasted, or sawn in two in the hells. The double-story wooden shrine, with its beautiful downward-sweeping roof, was jammed into a small courtyard between other buildings. As it was only 9 o'clock, we stood to one side and watched the worshippers buying flowers at the stalls, from which, on entering the courtyard, I had purchased a garland of jasmine. Looking up under the projecting eaves of the shrine, I caught a glimpse of gallery ceilings brightly painted with intricate lotus patterns. During the half-hour we waited, the cobbled space filled with white-clad figures, all holding above their heads little trays of flowers. As more and more worshippers surged in, those at the front were pushed up the temple steps and pressed against the low brass door, on the upper leaves of which were embossed the sun and the moon. As the minutes passed, I became aware of an undercurrent of excitement in the crowd, by this time so densely packed that the dark, glistening heads had disappeared beneath the sea of uplifted flowers. Every now and then would go up from the white mass of men and women on the temple steps a wail as of unutterable desire. It was as though I saw humanity clamouring for admission on the threshold of the divine. At 9:30 a side door opened and a dark finger beckoned. In and up we went, so quickly that I had no time to admire the curved and painted interior. The noise of the crowd faded to a murmur. Behind a massive steel grille stood, heaped with thick gold chains, a bell-shaped reliquary higher than a man. Above the altar, outside the grille, was suspended a silver canopy. From the ceiling, also of silver, hung little diamond ornaments like stars. Gold and silver images, miniature reliquaries and sprays of flowers, some studded with rubies, glittered about the base of the reliquary. The whole chamber was a blaze of gold and silver and jewels. Beside the altar stood an impassive figure in yellow robes. When I had offered my garland and gazed my fill at the reliquary, he showed me a tray of chased silver 3 feet in diameter. My guide whispered that this meant another offering. As we left the chamber, the door below was opened, and the crowd streamed past us up the stairs with their trays of flowers. In the octagonal library, formerly the throne room of the Candian kings, I was shown ancient palm-leaf manuscripts, some of them the gift of Sir Edwin Arnold, the famous Victorian poet, orientalist, and newspaper editor, who had written The Light of Asia. After scratching the name of the temple with an iron stylus on a strip of palm leaf, which was rubbed with ink to make the Sinhalese characters visible, another impressive yellow figure opened a drawer and looked at me with what was almost a smile. Without any prompting from the guide, I dropped a note onto the little pile of paper currency inside. In Ceylon, monks are not allowed to handle money. After a week in the hills, among the temples and monasteries of Kandy, I returned to Colombo, where I found the Swamis preparing for the arrival of a very senior monk who was president of an ashram in the Himalayas and a member of the governing body of the mission. "He is a great disciplinarian," they informed me. Discipline for me having acquired a rather unpleasant connotation, I awaited the arrival of the visitor with interest, but also with apprehension. Swami Pavitrananda was tall and thin and almost grotesquely bony. His eyes burned darkly in their hollow sockets. When he spoke, it was in a low, intense voice that was almost a whisper, and with impressive earnestness. The other two Swamis emanated a mild glow of spirituality, but he was a consuming fire. Like a moth by a flame, I was immediately attracted, for his very look showed me that if he was a disciplinarian, it was not to others, but to himself. He was, in fact, of an extremely affectionate disposition. In Calcutta, a few months later, I often heard other members of the mission speak of him as a very loving soul. Bengalis never say affectionate. In me, he at once took great interest, and we had many conversations. Unlike the other Swamis, he did not speak about philosophy or literature or music, but only of the spiritual life. The need for simplicity, purity, humility, and devotion were his sole topics. He often spoke of the necessity for renunciation and of the happiness of a monk's life, compared with which worldly happiness was as dross. As I listened, my heart burned within me. Whether he asked me if I wanted to be a monk, or whether I asked him if he thought it was possible for me to take up the monastic life, I do not remember. But from that time onwards, I was resolved upon a life of renunciation. In my next letters home, I told my parents that I was thinking of staying on in India after demobilization and becoming a monk. Since they were aware of my interest in Eastern religions, the news may not have been entirely unexpected. At any rate, they raised no objections. My father replied that my life was my own, and that I must do with it what I thought best. My mother, that she hoped my becoming a monk would not prevent me from seeing her sometimes. Before leaving Colombo, Swami Pavitrananda invited me to stay with him at Almora in the Himalayas, and advised me to visit Belur Math near Calcutta, the mission's headquarters. As soon as Vaishakha Purnima Day, anniversary of the Buddha's enlightenment, had been celebrated by the ashram with the usual lengthy speeches and marathon musical items, I therefore applied for a transfer to Calcutta on compassionate grounds, stating that I had an uncle living there whom I wanted to meet.